Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the curated online cinema. For your 1 month free trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the 200th episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And Michael Snydell.
Woo!
Yeah! And we are here...
200th episode.
200th episode. Everyone, I want to say right off the bat to stick around after the main review. We will be having an actual conversation with Nick Newman and Danny King, who helped me to create this show, lo, those many years ago.
And what?
I know, right? That'll be dropped.
And now you guys
in.
Are stuck with me.
We've cycled through a bunch of people, and, you know, we're stuck with Michael now. But we're very happy to be stuck with you. We wouldn't have asked you back if you weren't decently all right. But that will be happening.
And available.
and available.
Keyword.
The most important part. But yes, that conversation with Nick and Danny will be happening after the review. And that will be how we celebrate this, the 200th episode of the Film Stage Show. Who would have thought that this would last for this long? Certainly not me. The only person who's been here for every episode. Sometimes I look back on my life and I simply cry. We will be talking today about Suicide Squad, the newest film in the DCU. And that is why we're playing a song by Nirvana right now. Because I was thinking to myself, I thought, Brian, what music should we play during this episode? And I was like, we could have songs about the bad guys and something. You know, Behind Blue Eyes would be a good choice. Or maybe it's something about teaming up and fighting people. And then I thought, why not just feature music by people who actually committed suicide? So we've got Nirvana right now, and stick around at the end of the episode. We'll be spinning some Elliott Smith for you.
Oh, going deep. Going deep.
If you're an artist and you killed yourself, you were considered for this episode. Before we get into all of that, everyone... that now that we are 200 episodes old, we have sponsorship. And our sponsor for this episode is Mubi, the curated online cinema. What is Mubi? It's curated online cinema. I feel like I've already talked this out with you people, but I'll tell you again. It's a place where you can find exceptional cult, classic, and award-winning films from around the world. Every day they introduce a new hand-picked film, and you have 1 month to watch it. And this summer... Mubi is showing an ongoing retrospective of the works of Werner Herzog, but they're also showing a retrospective of the works of Kelly Reichardt.
Ooh.
I know. So, currently on Mubi, you can watch such films as Wendy and Lucy, Old Joy, which is a movie that I enjoy very much, and actually just added today was Meek's Cutoff.
Oh.
Mm.
Yeah, see, with those little hmms, you know it's a good idea. And the best thing is... that you can try out Mubi for 1 month for free by going to mubi.com/filmstage. We love Mubi. We want you to love Mubi. And we're going to give you a month free so you can check it out and understand exactly what it is we love about it. Because it's not just the fact that you can download movies to your tablet or smartphone. It's not just the fact that you can watch it on apps, on a bunch of different players. It's the fact that it's freaking awesome. It's a great, great service, and we are very happy to have partnered with them. So again, that is mubi.com/filmstage. Mubi.com. I don't think they have a tagline, so maybe we should invite people to tweet at us what they believe Mubi's taglines should be. And then I can scream them at you at the end of every Mubi plug. I'm down for that idea. Tweet them at us. Hashtag movie plug. But that's it for that. Today, we're going to be talking about Suicide Squad. And since I know that whenever we talk about a comic book movie, people really like to talk back to us, here's something places you can do that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, this movie probably never going to be on movie.
No. Unless they do a retrospective of the films of David Ayer.
Probably not even.
Probably not.
It might be like a Hearts of Darkness type thing, you know, but years on when people talk about this.
You can find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook. I almost called it the Facebook, as though I'd somehow magically transported myself back to 2005.
The mini faced book. The mini faced book.
You can find us on Facebook to search for The Film Stage Show. You can also email us podcast at thefilmstage.com. And you can find these episodes posted on thefilmstage.com. And you can yell at us there in the discussion section at the bottom. We always love that. It's always good times. Whew. So here we are, guys. 200 episodes. And it's all been leading up to this. Suicide Squad. The newest film by writer-director David Ayer, who has done great work in the past with things like End of Watch and the very well-regarded Fury. And it stars Will Smith, Margot Robbie, Jared Leto, Ike Barinholtz is in there, oddly enough, if you can believe that, as well as Viola Davis and Joel Kinnaman, amongst many, many others. Here is the trailer.
Is this the real life?
Let me out of here, Donald, please.
Let me out of here, brother!
Is this just fantasy?
Come on!
Caught in a landslide. No escape from reality.
I want to assemble a task force of the most dangerous people on the planet.
They're bad guys. Worst of the worst.
Too late.
Open the gate!
My time has come. Send shivers down my spine.
Was this a cheerleading trials?
So that is the trailer for Suicide Squad. This is a, I'm going to say, sequel in-universe cross-narrative.
Yes.
It's
certainly in conversation. Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman.
And Man of Steel. And, yeah, it's you couldn't have a simpler, more catchy premise for a movie. Basically, immediate spoilers for Batman v Superman. I feel super bad for anyone who's like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to skip Batman v Superman because I know how that's going to end. I'm just going to see Suicide Squad because it looks better.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you haven't seen Batman v Superman, but you're planning on seeing Suicide Squad, maybe rethink that, because this movie makes no bones about the fact that Batman died. And
nope.
So in the wake.
Nope.
Superman. You might want to correct
Superman. That. Superman died.
Spoilers.
So it makes no bones about the fact that Superman died. And in the vacuum left by Superman's corpse, they've decided, they being a dark part of the federal government, that they're going to assemble a team of metahumans, which is what they're calling specially abled people in this universe.
Are they called mutants? Is that what you're talking about?
No, they're not mutants. They're metahumans.
Okay.
And they're going to utilize these people and their gifts to fight. You know, they bring up the fact, like, what if the next Superman is a terrorist?
Mm-hmm.
I would say that in that case, we're all dead. And we should just give up immediately. But their idea is to get these villains together and implant them with explosives in their spines and make them fight on the side of good. And
yeah,
that's
no holes there at all.
No. I mean, that is a weird idea, but as far as weird ideas go, like, that's a great idea for a movie. Because in every film, people are like, you know what? Let me rephrase this. In every previous Batman film, the whole thing has always been Batman's a drag, his villains are awesome, why can't we spend more time with the villains? Now, the Marvel films have shown that you can make boring villains, really, really easily. So, but this movie had a chance to take the most colorful, craziest characters who we're usually rooting against only because they want to destroy us all, and give us a chance to root for them against our better instincts. They could be the Don Drapers / Walter Whites of the DC Cinematic Universe. Let's see how they did. Let's kick it off with Bill Graham. Bill, what did you think of Suicide Squad? And can we also say, in this world where we make fun of people so much for being really touchy about things, the fact that this made it into theaters with the title Suicide Squad is a small miracle.
Yeah, I heard about that kind of controversy.
I never even heard a controversy about it.
Yeah.
People just didn't care. They're like, yeah, self-extermination, do it.
So many other things to get mad about.
Yes, there is. Oh, man. Okay, so this movie, man. I gotta say right off the bat that this film is getting slaughtered by critics. And now, I haven't read a lot of reviews about it, because I typically like to watch the movie before I read a full review. Which is also one of the benefits of this podcast, right? We review it and then we spoil the shit out of it. So, you know, you get a little extra. It's not just a standard review. But this film is getting pretty slaughtered. And a lot of DC fans are kind of, I guess they're riled up, and it's riling up the critics as well. And
there's a full on gang fight brewing.
Yeah, there's just kind of a toxic recycling going on, and it kind of sucks because honestly, like this film, what people like put a lot of effort into and everything like that, it doesn't necessarily deserve this kind of vitriol and things like that. And
Bill, I want to ask for clarification. You say people put a lot of effort into it. You're definitely not talking about anything that's actually in this film, right? You're talking about people putting effort into like slamming it or defending it?
No. I'm talking about like this is a movie and it takes a long process, and it took, I'm sure, several years of David Ayer's life to create this.
And 6 weeks to write the script.
But time does not equal effort.
I would say that he put a lot of effort into this.
Okay.
I would probably say that. There's a question of whether that effort was well spent or not, right?
Or whether that effort was respected by the studio.
Sure. That's another thing. And those are the kind of things that, honestly, no matter how much is written about it, no matter how much is said, no matter how much is revealed, we probably still won't even know the full truth of what actually happened behind the scenes. Same thing with Rogue One. Same thing with a lot of these films.
Until these artists do a full John Leguizamo and just decide to write a book that burns all their bridges, we probably will never know.
And even then, we'll probably have, you know, two sides. But that's a long way. Go ahead.
I was going to say, just in case anyone who's listening doesn't know, there's a Hollywood Reporter, correct? Hollywood Reporter?
Yes.
They put out an article that talked about the combative, tumultuous post-production on this, and how the company that was used to make the first trailer, which was well-regarded, was actually brought in to help recut the film from David Ayer's original cut.
Is that the first time that's ever happened? I didn't
can't
research
imagine
it too
that
much.
It is, but I don't know of any others off the top of my head.
It must be for the first time we actually know about it, or it's been
talked
about.
Sure.
So there were reshoots and re-edits and stuff was added to spice it up and make it more like that first trailer. So you can go online, go to the Hollywood Reporter, and read that to get some idea of what we're talking about when we talk about the the frankly ridiculous backstory behind the creation of this film. But Bill Graham, all of that taken into account.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting down, watching this movie.
Yeah.
Good thing, bad thing.
I'd say it's right down the middle. Honestly, this film, as I was watching it, I was like, oh, okay, that's okay. Oh, okay, that's okay. Oh, okay, that's okay. This film is extremely okay, in my opinion. It doesn't necessarily, like, I mean, there are things that we'll probably go off on a tangent on and that are bad, and there are, honestly, there's much more bad with this movie than there is good. I can't think of a single sequence that I could put my finger on and say, you need to see this movie for this reason. Maybe a performance, maybe something like that, but that's not a scene, that's not a sequence. And let's be honest, when we show up for a superhero movie like this, that isn't necessarily The Dark Knight, that isn't necessarily something that's trying to be kind of, you know, big and bravado and
meaningful.
Meaningful, sure. And, you know, when we show up for this film, we're wanting A, it to be pretty, B, to wow us, right, to have some cool special effects or have some cool sequences, and honestly, it didn't do a whole lot of that.
Nope.
No.
It didn't necessarily, like I said, it didn't necessarily do all that much wrong that I was just like, oh my god, get, you know, stop doing this, but there just wasn't that wow factor that, honestly, I watched the trailers, I dug the trailers, I'm a fan of Ayer. I was really looking forward to this film. I thought this was going to really be the one that really kind of kicked in the door, maybe opened some doors for having a little bit more fun with the genre and stuff like that. You can get away from just having superheroes fight bad guys all the time. Like, let's kind of switch it up. Let's mix it up. And
yeah,
honestly,
see some shit from the villain side. Like,
yeah, sure.
The whole movie about villains is frankly a great idea.
Yeah, and here's the issue. These villains aren't that bad.
No, like, they're not.
Like,
no.
If you switch their names and kind of wiped out their backstory a little bit, like, they would actually be good guys. Like,
I'll be 100%. Sure. I just want to say this one thing and see what y'all think. Deadshot is a better person than Clark Kent / Superman.
In the Man of Steel universe, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He is responsible for fewer deaths. He seems to have a stronger moral code.
He doesn't kill women and children.
Right. Yeah, no women and children.
He has a firm relationship with a relation of his daughter. I mean, like, and he's there.
He's a productive
he's present,
member of society in some way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this film, it just doesn't do a whole lot right, and even the effort it makes to kind of set this up is, ooh, these are the bad guys, and they're gonna do some bad stuff, and it's like, the whole time I'm watching it, I'm like, they still haven't done anything bad. like not really.
I don't know,
like,
Harley steals a purse.
Oh, man. Woo!
Because she's a bad guy.
Yeah. And overall, I thought the introductions of all the characters was both it was the biggest highlight, but it was also the biggest moment that I just continually rolled my eyes throughout, because they do this thing where they introduce these characters and they kind of give a backstory and they tell you how they captured them and put this team together called Project X or Team X.
I think it's Task Force X.
Task Force X. I guess there's been a lot of other Task Force. I don't know if that's like X as in number 10 or X as in just like they went all the way down that alphabet. I'm really curious, like, what happened to Task Force Q? Like, I really want to know about Q.
It seems like it's a choice made to make it seem secretive. But
sure.
Popular culture has used that so often that you'd think a government official who wanted to keep it secret would name it Task Force R. Because that just sounds so boring.
Yeah. Task Force Blue. Let's there just go with Task Force.
The boring mentality is what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Like Treadstone. Snooze. Sure. Next one.
So I think some... Honestly, I think Will Smith, he's not really had a lot of critical love lately. He does great in this role. I adored his character. I adored his role, his performance throughout. I thought he was really the heart and soul of this film. A lot of people are going to latch onto Margot Robbie, and probably rightfully so. I think she gives a fine performance. I think her character is kind of complete crap. I don't necessarily think all of it works. And so I can't say, I mean, certainly she took something that was probably very easily just a one-note kind of character, and she rounded the edges just a little bit. And that was just sheer force of will from what I can tell. It had nothing to do with the script, because the script really doesn't give her a whole lot to do. It's just her. Leto as the Joker, honestly, 5 minutes of him and I was like, woo, no more. And then five more minutes of him and I was like, okay, I'm kind of into this. So you get 10 minutes total.
And then he's out of the movie.
Yeah, you get 10 minutes total of him, and honestly, it's like, it's a wash. It's
50% of that you can bear.
Yeah. So what does this movie ultimately do? What does this movie ultimately set up? Honestly, I really don't know.
That's the perfect note to go out on. Yes. What does this movie do? I don't know.
It certainly is pretty at times. It certainly kind of has enough momentum to keep it going. But honestly, this is just so mediocre that it's frustratingly mediocre is what it is. I couldn't get excited for just about anything in this film. So that's holy shit, the licensing of the music in this movie must have been a nightmare.
Man. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Millions of dollars.
Yeah. Just I don't insane. Know whose idea that was, but
it was probably someone who remembered the movie Guardians of the Galaxy and how well that did.
Or it was a member of Task Force Q.
I stopped no counting longer when it hit double digits in the first like 15 minutes.
Oh my god, I was trying to make a list. It really was like every time that there was a cut, there was a new song playing.
Oh, man.
And then around the time that, what's her name? Amanda Waller, who's played by Viola Davis, who is a good guy, a member of the U.S. government, who wants to use this task force for good, showed up to the song Sympathy for the Devil. I was like, fuck it, I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's the thing, like you can kind of say, oh, it's kind of a riff on Guardians of the Galaxy. And I think overall, I think maybe even Tarantino is kind of responsible for a lot of this stuff. But Tarantino gives us deep cuts, and even Guardians had some stuff that like you were like, oh yeah, I remember that song. I just haven't heard it in like 15
years. I haven't thought of
years.
That song in a while.
It was like Left this, of the Dial FM radio.
Yeah, and so this time around, it's like, hey, if you got the greatest of like the 80s and the 70s and like put them together and then just spun around and pointed at, you know, the list, you would end up on like pretty much all of these songs in the first 15 minutes. And you're just like, oh, come on. Like,
that,
like you gotta give me like a deep cut. You gotta give me
and
something.
Eminem.
Oh Jesus.
You know, what's crazy. You know, what's okay. This is, I don't know why I'm bringing this up here, but I guess it's cause we're talking about music. Eminem has a song called Criminal.
Oh Jesus. Come on.
He has a song and it's like, it's a hard, like mean song. And then they go with, will the real Slim Shady please stand up?
Well, the lyrics just didn't, you know, it didn't draw them in, man. I don't know.
No, none of these songs.
Probably because these guys aren't fucking real criminals.
Sure. That's where it's the shticky version of criminals.
Right.
It's all talk.
I can't imagine a single one of these people being the antagonist in a movie.
Man.
Like, okay, so here's...
You, wait, Michael, can you?
Like, seriously, there's a guy named Captain Boomerang.
I mean, guys, are they any worse than some of the Marvel villains, though? I mean, really.
They're not.
It's
but,
hard to tell.
They
like
try
the Thor
to play
2
them
villain.
The Dark Elves?
Yeah, the Dark Elves. Oh. Let's just refrain from ever talking about Thor 2 ever again. Like if we could do that, that would be great. That would be really great.
That's the one where they're trying to get ether
so
they can jump through holes in reality.
Oh my god!
And the Dark Elves are trying to do something, because
my brain is melting.
The misfortune of being named Dark, so that means they're evil, because we're still rocking along on that way. Here's the thing. I was gonna address Michael's question. I mean, those Marvel villains have plans that are demonstrably bad for me. So if a dark elf wants to use the ether to take over transdimensional travel and destroy the universe, I'm having a bad day. If Harley wants to dance in a club and be pimped out to Common and then drive super fast with her fucking psycho boyfriend, I don't care. Like, neither of them seems intent on pulling off anything above, like, just being a dick to, like, a convenience store clerk. Like, they legitimately seem like two teenagers who are just awful, but not particularly dangerous.
Sure.
Killer Croc. I don't know what he
seriously
used to do.
like guys, in the video games and in the animated series, mm-hmm. and some of the other some of the other animated stuff and some of the comic books, like, this dude is gigantic, and he actually serves a threat. I just look at Killer Croc and I'm like, don't nibble on me, dude. Just don't nibble on me. Like that's it.
If I ran into him on a city bus, I would maybe change seats. But other than that, he doesn't seem that bad. None of these people seem that bad.
I mean,
and
he
that's
might
a real problem.
Wow, but
and so what this film kind of what this film kind of sets up and the idea behind it is that literally these are people that you would never want to be around, right? That's how bad we have. And it's like, I'd probably share a beer with just about every single one of these people. Like, yeah. I'd probably be like, all right, cool. Let's talk. You're crazy.
Yeah. I have had conversations with people more unhinged and more of an immediate threat to me than I believe Harley would be.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who were also women. And then Will Smith, it's like, if no one's paying him to kill you, he seems like he'd be pretty cool to hang out with. He's got a wide-brim pimp hat, you know.
I wonder how much style he brought to that himself. I'm very curious.
He bought a doll for his daughter that was legitimately called Baby Doll.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, outside of Viola Davis's character, everyone in here seems pretty all right. I mean, I guess we can talk about Enchantress. Does anyone remember?
Or
she's kind of legit evil.
Captain Boomerang legit seems to only murder people who are robbing banks with him.
Yeah. And I couldn't tell if he was chugging beer or chugging energy drinks. I couldn't tell.
I kept assuming it was energy drinks because he was so weird, and the idea of, like, having an Australian villain and just having him constantly produce a can of beer seemed really weird to me.
Guys, this is the most anyone has ever talked to Jai Courtney before about this movie, about him. Oh, I can't talk. Yeah.
Well, Michael, why don't you give us your opinion of this film?
Well, I'm kind of right with Bill. I actually watched BBS very recently, and I didn't hate it as much as you guys, but I definitely was looking at my watch every once in a while, and, you know, I didn't have that feeling watching this movie, but, you know, afterwards when I, you know, tried to get my thoughts together, it's really a whole lot of nothing, which is what Bill started to get into, and I mean, the whole copy-paste storytelling really becomes a problem in the second half, as, you know, I don't know. It's just the thing I kept thinking about is that this movie has no idea what it wants to be. I'm at times, you know, it feels comparable to, like, David Ayer, specifically the procedural, like End of Watch. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of, you know, similar, I don't want to say investigations, because that's too deep of a word for how deep it goes into character developments. But, you know, it does start to talk about things about, you know, flexible moral codes, and even gets into like relatively interesting ideas about, you know, fantasies of normalcy and what, you know, when the villains actually recognize what, you know, when they're going too far. Like, I think there is literally a line of dialogue where a character has a realization, like, you know, maybe this is too evil or something along those lines. But honestly, my biggest problem with this movie is one that's happened a lot with superhero movies lately, at least in my opinion, and it's that I have no sense of the scale of power between both the heroes as well as the villains. Right. So especially when we get late into the movie, and I'm not going to bring up any specific details right now, even in basic fights, I don't have a sense, you know, who's just really good at shooting a gun and who, you know, has superpowers, for lack of a better term.
Sure. Like this film does not do a very good job of, like let's talk about Harley real quick.
Sure.
What is her superpower? Nothing.
She's the 2016 All-American home run champion.
Sure.
I don't know. So she also has a gun.
Yeah,
she has a gun that she seems real good with, as
well
as a baseball bat.
She's nimble. She's quick. She can swing a mean bat. But beyond that, I'm just like, you know. And
she's
look,
like
this,
if that cheerleader you had a crush on were cross with that softball player you were afraid of.
I don't know what that means,
I'm not
but
touching
okay.
That one.
Okay. Anyways, what I'm gonna move on to is she has the same issue as Joker, except Joker is a mastermind criminal. That's his shtick, right? Same with the Penguin. The Penguin doesn't do anything extraordinary. He's just he just is the guy behind all of this chaos and all of this crazy stuff and a crime lord. And the
right.
same
they're
with the Joker.
Charismatic leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're leaders and it's the people around them that mainly do the bad stuff. Or every now and then they one up someone. They get the upper hand. But you can't sure. have an entire film where Harley is constantly one-upping everybody around her. That just doesn't make any logical sense. It doesn't work like that. She has to have a reason why she – and it's not like she ever puts anything crazy into action. She doesn't do anything crazy in this film. All she does is she walks around in really short boy shorts and – it swings a bat and hits everything. And it's just like, okay, cool. What's different between you and the Navy SEALs that are around you?
Absolutely.
Nothing. I don't understand. Like, it just does. And that keeps happening. It's the same with kind of Killer Croc. It's the same with a lot of these guys where you're just like, cool. If Superman actually landed in the middle of y'all, y'all would be toast. Like literally toast. I don't understand how y'all are the anti-venom or whatever you want to call it, right?
I mean, Will Smith's character is literally just good with a gun.
Yeah.
They say he never misses. I don't know if that's like a thing of his or if he just has tried, if he's like hit his 10,000 hours and he's just great.
Guys, I just want to say I am tempted. I'm not going to say that the film is articulate about this at all, but I am tempted to say that Ayer did want it to be that a little, be that way and, you know, have much of their, you know, sense of power come from a thing of control.
Right,
there's,
sure.
You know, one of the best scenes happens late in the bar when they're talking. I can't say a lot comes out of that scene, but at least there is a sense that, like, Ayer's script views these characters as, you know, they're subjects of impulsivity more than any type of, like, that just happen to sometimes have, you know, I'm going to say deformities. Not deformities, but, like, superhuman attributes that allow them to be useful and, you know, also ultimately make them outcasts or things like that. It's more... I do get the sense that even the script is like, yeah, who cares if they're not superheroes? They're totally disposable anyway. But then it's also, you know, going against the dictates of what is needed for a superhero film, and that sense of power that you need on screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that bar sequence is probably the highlight of the movie for me. And especially with Diablo, or mm-hmm. I guess his name
Jay
is
Hernandez.
Jay Hernandez, right? I actually really enjoyed his character as
best
well.
Best character in the movie.
Yeah.
Sure.
Maybe not.
He just doesn't have enough screen time and things going on. But he's probably also, outside of Enchantress, the one person that actually has superpowers as well, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is being a crocodile a superpower?
I thought
that's
we already established.
That's a legit question. I don't know.
breathing underwater, I guess, has its perks, right?
Yeah.
He does swim well.
They're getting us ready for Aquaman, guys.
Well, first, let me ask. Michael, have you said your piece on this movie in totality at the moment?
Shoot, I believe I had something else. But, you know what? Yeah, I'm good for now.
Okay. So, I have so many problems with this movie, and I wrote the review for this movie for the film stage, and as I finished, I was like, I could probably double this, but it's already like 1,300 words, and I don't need that in my life. So, this movie starts with two characters being introduced, then it starts with, again, after the credits, with more characters being introduced, including those two characters.
Remember Slipknot, Brian?
Yeah. Then it goes to a new scene of the same person who introduced them the second time, reintroducing them to a new group of people. And then it goes to them meeting each other, and we're actually introduced to Deadshot for a fourth time, and they use the music that was in the trailer of The Wolf of Wall Street as he's shooting things. And okay, let's talk about a movie that's about a band of misfits who come together to beat an unstoppable enemy against all odds, even though no one, even the person in charge of them, believes in them. That movie is The Mighty Ducks.
Here goes the dynamite.
The Mighty Ducks sets up the problem, which would be the Hawks, and then it builds a team and shows them learning from each other mm-hmm. and gaining trust and respect, even with the kid who they call the Cake Eater because he used to be on the Hawks. But suddenly they're all together, these former enemies and these misfits.
How recently have you seen Mighty Ducks, Brian?
not that recently, actually. But the Ducks,
his superpower is his mind.
The Ducks band together, overcome all odds, and in a climactic third act, battle the Hawks.
Spoilers.
And even though the Cake Eater is taken out and has his shoulder broken by the Hawks, his friends band together, and they defeat them using the mighty Flying V, which is the thing that only they could come up with because they don't play by the rules.
Yeah,
except
man.
That, you know, they play by all the other rules because they don't cheat. So that movie spends time building these characters up and making us love this team and then shows them going into something. This movie names all of its characters, spending about 40 minutes on that, and then immediately jumps into what feels like the third act.
Yeah.
Which then
lasts. They have 10 minutes to like get dressed and roll out.
Right.
It's like, what?
And they've never met each other really at all. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, told all the shit that will happen to them if they do poorly. And then they have a mission that we, the audience, don't know about. And
I kind of liked that though. I just want to say that.
Yeah, that was fine-ish, but like, it felt, it was literally like, okay, but what are they doing? Like, there's that giant, if they had said, don't pay attention to the giant death ray in the sky, that's unimportant, we've got that handled, your job is to do something else. Like, that would have made sense, but like,
sure.
This is an abandoned city, and I don't know why these people are the only people who could do it, because after they fight their way through the city and into this building, they just call in another helicopter.
Yeah.
And this is a movie really... where three helicopters are shot out of the sky and no one perishes in those helicopter crashes.
I think some people die. But here's my big issue. Helicopters fly up, the last I remember, right? They can go up, like straight up.
Yeah, but Bill, why would you do that when you could go 5 feet above the ground in a city and be subjected to small arms fire?
Exactly. Exactly.
Why wouldn't you just do that?
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And especially I love how they use what are they called? They're
flares?
Huh?
Chafe and flares?
Yeah, yeah. To make sure that anti-tank guns or whatever, RPGs and stuff like that, heat-seeking missiles, like, and I'm like, guys, you're not fighting people, you're not fighting an army, like, you're literally not fighting an army. They do not have, they maybe have small arms, but mostly what they are doing is they're just trying to beat the pulp out of other people. Right. Like,
it takes no time to set up the team, and then yet, at the outset of the actual third act, I guess, or the climactic scene, they're trying to pretend like they've been working against something. Mm-hmm. And really, they're just a bunch of strangers who were plopped in a situation and told to walk in a direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they start saying, like...
But isn't that what kind of makes this film... Oh boy, I'm defending this now. Isn't this what...
Oh, no, you're fine.
Isn't this what kind of makes this film interesting a little bit? I kind of like that... So much of their early time is spent like, you know, how can we get out of being, you know, any semblance of forget a hero? We don't really want to do anything. We just want to. I think that's
going back to Jason Bourne, which we talked about. I mean, like, that's the crux of every story that he has.
Sure.
But he doesn't want to be involved.
In this movie, they're like, we're trying to get out. But it's not like it's not an evolving plan. It's not like there's a heist movie inside of a war movie inside of a Band of Misfits movie. It's just like scene by scene, shit just happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're sitting around drinking, Deadshot says something like, you know, they never thought we could do it. And it's like, no one gave a shit. Like, you don't act like you're trying to prove people wrong. You don't even want to be here, asshole.
Yep.
Like, And again, they just have to keep saying, we're bad guys. We're bad guys. Don't forget, we're the bad guys.
Sure.
It's because they're not. They're not that bad. And if that was the point of the movie, that would be great. But the movie wants you to feel like these people are dangerous. And they're not. And they're just not. It's crazy.
Well, I think the weird thing about it is, you know, if you're going to have a abandoned metropolis, and we can get into the... I have a pretty... not interesting theory. Interesting theory why, you know, they chose to write the story the way that they did. But, you know, like, if they really wanted to, you know, establish that sense of, you know, that sense of evil, or even just some sense of what a random person thinks of someone like Harley Quinn or Deadshot, like, why didn't they just, even if it was just some, you know, wounded rando in the street, why didn't they have some experience where they put Suicide Squad in contact with anyone, you know, who isn't a military person or anything like that? Mm-hmm. Like, there were so many opportunities where they could have at least established, you know,
like, what
something
if
on either spectrum.
Right. What if they had to stop Killer Croc from eating a kid?
Sure.
You know, what if they had to stop Harley from cutting up some guy? Like, what if they had to stop Deadshot from murdering someone for money?
Sure.
I don't know.
Or something even more boring than someone being like, hey, that's that major criminal I see on television or something.
Yeah.
Like, just something that says a random person knows who these people are or doesn't.
If they hadn't abandoned this city, then you could have something like that where, like, that maybe they're trying to, they've been forced to save a school bus full of children.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they're fighting the stupid soot monsters off. And they're like, you know, come on, we're going to get you out of here. And all the kids are, like, screaming and crying. And then they realize that they're not screaming and crying at the soot monsters. They're screaming and crying about a fucking man who looks like a crocodile.
Brian, you need to go to Hollywood right now.
Like, that's, and then that could give them the impetus to like maybe try a little harder. I don't know. Or to even turn their back on it more. Because yeah, then they're yeah. like, no matter what we do, people are always going to think we're evil. And then one of them Absolutely. Could say, you know, don't forget, we're pretty fucking evil.
Yeah.
And there's just so many opportunities and options. And that's what I wanted from this movie. But instead, you get this fucking empty backlot of a city. And then the villain is technically a member of their team, but they never talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's so many problems I had. They said that one of the reasons they wanted this team to be built of the bad guys is because they're expendable.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Expendables. They're the Suicide Squad. Now, that would mean that, like, you would send them in to a situation where you needed to take out a bad guy and you needed to make everything be able to be foisted on these people if it failed.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So what you should have is an entire city full of people who can't get out, and they're going to be like, we can't send the army in there because we don't want the bad press. And it's mm-hmm. like, well, let's send in these assholes. And then if everything goes to shit, we can just say it was their fault.
Yep.
Imagine it also makes no sense just that they're... That. Sorry.
Go ahead. Michael.
Go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry. It also makes no sense to me. I'm realizing now that if they are supposed to be totally expendable, you know, their mission is something that's pretty important that, you know, they need someone who is very reliable to do. I mean, we can get into this in spoilers, but like...
Yeah, because their first mission... is super important to yeah. the person who gave them the mission. Now, if their mission had only been go take out this crazy death ray, then yeah, fuck it. Send them in. Cannon fodder those
sure.
people. Bill, what were you going to say?
I was going to say it's hilarious because you're talking about like, oh, well, why didn't they just, you know, put the blame on someone and just keep using that? Kind of like what they did to Superman in Man of Steel, where they were just like, hey, Superman, go take out that dude. And when shit goes wrong and you knock down 20 buildings, we're just going to blame you. And it's like, that's the Suicide Squad, right?
And That's the time. That's one of the problems with this movie, is mm-hmm. that they keep trying to say, like, these are the worst of the worst. They're not acting any worse than Superman.
No.
And their collateral damage is so much less than his.
Yep.
It's yeah. insane that
they left a mess. They really did leave a mess, though. The guys, like...
Oh, yeah, there's that block-wide yeah. ring of rubble, I guess. And three helicopters that didn't used to be crashed there.
Guys, we haven't even gotten into how there is another plot that the movie just interrupts its own story to get into.
I think that's spoiler worthy-ish.
I think we're there, right?
Yeah,
we're
there. And then I'll just say again, like, the music choices in this are fucking ridiculous. Like, I was tired of the needle drops 15 minutes in.
Mm-hmm.
And
Well, lucky for you, it kind of stops at that moment.
Yeah, it does. Once it gets into the... Once again, they smash cut into the second act. Like, because they get on that helicopter, and I'm like, oh, they're doing this now. Like, they're not even having a team-building moment. Like, they're just going in. All right, well, that's fine. Yeah, then it kind of stops. Except for when Harley Quinn runs ahead of everyone, jumps into an elevator,
yeah.
gets into a fucking brawl, and then steps off like nothing happened.
That's a pretty good action scene, though, I have to say.
That has to have been a reshoot, right? Like, there's no reason for her to skip away like that, have that fight, and then just come off and say, like, okay, everything's fine.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, they're like, the building appears empty. And she could very clearly say to them, actually, I just had to kick the shit out of a bunch of coal monsters.
Sure.
I don't know. This is a frustrating movie because there's so much wrong with it that... It becomes like a mire that sucks you in, and the more you struggle against it, the more you realize how much is wrong with it. Because I like
it just as an undercurrent.
Yeah. Because I liked Will Smith, because I liked Margot Robbie, and because mm-hmm. I liked Jay Hernandez, I was very close to giving this movie a C+, which would have given it a positive on Rotten Tomatoes. And then the more I wrote about it, and the more I realize the fundamental problems on a filmmaking level, stuff that we've talked about, like the insane editing, the poor pacing, the bad music choices.
Like honestly, this seems like a DC executive or someone like that just going, yeah, here's some cool shit. Let's do that. Yeah, here's some. It doesn't feel like David Ayer is the man behind this film. Like that's what it doesn't feel like. And it just feels
his
soulless.
Sense of danger and anarchy is completely gone. And I like his films. And it's also crazy because outside of the introduction panels, the crazy candy colored zany pop madness aesthetic of the marketing isn't there either. Which is the only other reason that this seemed like it could be cool. So it's just
Brian,
a fucking
I wanted to bring up that Ayer thing. Like I must admit I'm kind of late to Ayer. A couple days before I saw the film, I caught up on Fury and End of Watch, and I liked both of them. I especially liked End of Watch with despite some qualms with the last act. But I understand it. This movie needed to be PG-13, but if you're going to hire Ayer, for better or for worse, Ayer's aesthetic is gratuitously violent. And it's about actively recognizing that. Like the best parts of Watch and Fury are offering the opposite of the desensitization that comes with violence in most things. About throwing yourself into horrors and atrocities, and then the characters either acclimating to it or receding and things along those lines.
He wants his violence to shock you.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's a scene in End of Watch where a patrolman has a knife in his eye and is just holding it there. I mean, that's dark shit.
Yes, and there's that, and there's still, I mean, you briefly mentioned the soot monster, but it obviously seems made to, get that PG-13 rating, but it seems to also go against the entire aesthetic of what is...
Hiring David Ayer to make a PG-13 superhero film is like hiring John Hillcoat to make a PG-13 rated superhero film, because again, regardless of what you think about their dim view of humanity... Mm-hmm. They are cinematic auteurs who, live to make people bleed on screen.
Yeah.
They're in love with the result of violence. They're not Olivier Megaton.
Sure.
They're going to fucking shoot someone and then linger on them for 3 minutes so you understand what it is to be shot.
And as much as it gets, as immature as Ayer's scripts are, he really, really misses the F word here. And
oh my God,
the dialogue just does not have that, pitter patter, it's missing that juvenile quality.
What it does maintain is his street level misogyny.
Yeah.
And that's a problem that we can talk about in spoilers. I say let's do it. Let's jump into spoilers, because we've already been talking about this movie for almost a fucking hour now.
And we haven't gotten into anything.
I mean, we've gotten into a lot, but it's all foundational stuff. Like, now we can really rock into the details. So,
let's roll
about Joker
out.
At
let's
all
roll
before,
out, guys.
We get into, before we get into spoilers.
Okay, the final thing before we go into spoilers. Let's not talk about Joker's place in the movie, but let's just say, what did you think of Joker?
Not me. I already said what I thought of Joker.
Michael. You requested this.
I know. I kind of liked him.
Oh no.
I liked about 50% of him. Like there's a sequence where he shows up in a casino. We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
And he slaps a guy on the shoulders, and he coos and purrs as he, and I was just like, I'm into this. I like this. Give me more of this. And what does he do? He gives me no more of that. And I'm like, no, I don't understand. So, his manic intensity throughout this film is kind of it's infectious. it is one of the moments where the film actually seems to actually function correctly. It seems to actually do something. Now, his interaction with Harley is complete and utter trash. Sure. But besides that, the relationship and everything that they kind of do for each other and things like that, I really kind of enjoy that. It just sucks that that's 10 minutes of this movie and there's no more of it. And instead, we have to go into this dark fucking city and stay there for an hour and a half. And I'm just like, sure. no, give me like Joker. Point blank is a pop of color every single time he's on screen, whether it's his hair, whether it's his stupid purple Lamborghini, whatever it is,
whether it's his laughing hand tattoo.
The tattoos on this dude are just absolutely absurd. And you know,
when that publicity image of him came out, I was like, I was one of the few people who defended it. I said, you know how like that there was that one person, and now I can't even remember who it was, who posed naked on a magazine cover with like the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence on their back.
Why am I thinking that's like the Dixie Chicks? Actually,
I don't know. I would Google naked Declaration of Independence right now, but I don't feel like I ought to.
Yeah,
but like, I was thinking like maybe that's what that is. Maybe those aren't going to be written on him. Like maybe it's not, but it's there. It's damaged as across his forehead, and that's a problem for me because I always believed that the Joker believed that his response to everything made sense.
Mm-hmm. He's
existential,
not
existential villain. He is the man who realizes that madness is the only true way to survive, and that's a problem with a lot of this movie. Actually, now that I think about it, is that the best villains don't believe themselves to be acting villainously.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have people literally saying, "We're bad guys," that's a fucking problem. And it doesn't feel like they're saying it to the army people to be glib. It doesn't seem like, "You want me to be evil? I'll show you evil, bitch." It's like, no, it's just who we are. It's not who we are. It's what we do. So
I think like, you know, this is such a quintessential Jared Leto performance. You know, if you've seen his past performances, you know, whether I guess Dallas Buyers Club is the one that's specifically coming into my mind right now. I mean, you are going to be on board or you're going to say, get him the fuck off the screen right now.
Sure. When I think of Jared Leto, I still think of Requiem for a Dream, which isn't this, obviously, but isn't even seemingly from the same human being as this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But so I don't know what happened to Jared Leto. Who knows? So spoilers, are we ready for spoilers? Ready to get right into the plot? If it could be called that. So spoilers for Suicide Squad.
I'm ready. Give it to me.
Let's do this.
I'm gonna do us all a favor. I'm going to say what the plot of this movie is very quickly.
Sure.
And then we can get into it. So one of the members of the Suicide Squad is Dr. June Moon. M-O-O-N-E.
That sounds really bad when you say it out loud.
She has been possessed by the many thousand-year-old spirit of an interdimensional being known only as Enchantress.
Like an Aztec.
Yeah. apparently that's when she was like caught, so that's like where she is. Like a person who wakes up from a coma that they went into in the 80s who immediately dresses in like neon and shoulder pads. So Enchantress is controlled by Amanda Waller because she has her heart in a case. And
she threatens to stab it, and at some point she does stab it.
Yeah.
Like very violently.
To stop her from, she controls her because she has her heart. So they bring Enchantress in as a member of this team. Now Enchantress is dormant and June Moon will be in control, except when she says the word Enchantress. And what happens is that Joel Kinnaman's character, who we didn't talk about at all, Lieutenant Flag or Sergeant Flag?
Yep.
Rick Flag.
Rick Flag. Pretty boy Rick Flag. He has fallen in love with June Moon, and I don't know if he's
quick
controlling
her. I'm gonna die if you keep calling her that.
Rick Flag has fallen in love with Dr. June Moon.
No.
And I don't know if he's controlling her, or she's controlling him, or both of them are kind of controlling each other. But June Moon says Enchantress.
It's just
in her
a whirlwind.
Sleep, and Enchantress goes to Midway City, finds the bottle that holds the soul of her brother, who we've never
Incubus.
Heard of, and she releases him into another man. And so this man becomes her brother Incubus in the same way that June Moon becomes Enchantress. He begins to destroy a city. This suicide squad isn't yet convened, but June Moon and Rick Flag are sent into that city, and for whatever reason, they need June to become Enchantress to go blow up Incubus.
Yep,
but she doesn't. She joins him, and she wants to make a doomsday machine to destroy the world because humans don't worship them anymore. They worship machines. Mm. So then the Suicide Squad is assembled. What happens then? Are they going to go fight Enchantress? No, they're not. They're going to go rescue Amanda Waller, who has decided to stay in the city and is now surrounded. And she stayed in the city so that she could watch Enchantress turn people into the smoke soot monsters, because she's like, that's a ready-made army. So apparently she's planning on doing that to civilians or some shit. And then when she gets out, she gets put on a helicopter. But the first helicopter that comes is actually the Joker, who's there to try to save Harley. And he does, but then they get hit. And then Harley magically ends up right back in front of that building to rejoin the team. Amanda Waller has been kidnapped. The team is now like, we have to go stop Enchantress. And then Rick Flag is like, you don't understand. That's my girlfriend. They didn't know that. We already did. It still played like a reveal to us. They go there. Enchantress is all like, hey, I could give you the worlds you want. And she shows Harley being with Joker as like Warden June Cleaver with a baby. And she shows Rick Flag being fine with June Moon, and it was all a bad dream. And then she shows Diablo that his wife isn't dead. P.S. Diablo accidentally murdered his entire family because he couldn't control his fire powers. And he's all like, even though I'm about to get a blowjob from my smoking hot wife, I know this isn't real. I'm going to stop this. And then he lets himself become a fire demon, almost kills Incubus. Croc, meanwhile, has gone below the ground, gotten the explosive device, kills Incubus because apparently explosives work. And then they stop Enchantress because Rick just crushes the heart and Deadshot shoots a satchel bomb, even though his daughter's like, don't do it, daddy, echoing the Batman thing that happened earlier. Even though, why would she be asking him not to shoot a backpack?
Yeah.
Then everything is sort of fine at the end. Everyone's in jail, but they all get a little bit of something to help make things easier. And then Joker busts in and is like, baby doll, let's get out of here. And Harley's all like, Mr. J. And then it's credits.
Woo,
so which
bravo,
part of that would
bravo.
We like to talk about first?
God damn, that's oh my God, bravo. Bravo.
You know, maybe this movie's worse than I thought. Never mind.
Okay, guys. One thing I got to bring up that I found absolutely hilarious was, so you see Enchantress and she's trying to make this machine because the humans no longer worship them, right? The Incans and whatever the Mayans, whatever they were, they no longer worship them. And I'm feeling very Shades of American Gods right now, but,
right.
Like, okay, sure, cool. You're not being worshipped anymore. You still got all your superpowers, though, right? Yeah? Okay, so what's your problem? I don't understand. But also, she says that she's going to create a machine that I guess everybody else worships. And I'm just like, guys, they already made that. It's called Facebook. But the other thing is, I don't understand the end game there at all.
She's just going to murder everyone, it seems like.
Yeah.
Take them back to a primitive state. Because as we see,
because that worked well, right?
A major communication satellite is destroyed. We see this in a video feed in the Pentagon that must have been taken by yet another video communication satellite.
Guys, we need to talk about those cuts that are right around where we're shown the Doomsday device for the first time. And then we see cuts where there's destruction, like, and then it does like a shoot. I'm not remembering this well at all, but like a shot like of the exterior of the Earth and like Yeah. I have no sense of geography. You know, is it just Midway City that is, you know, screwed? Is it everyone in the city is just hiding? Is everyone already been transformed? I mean, I have no idea.
Evacuated most of them.
Yeah. So it's BVS is what you're saying.
Sure.
Yeah, basically.
That's an abandoned island.
Yeah.
But like real quick, I want to mention something hilarious that I saw. And of course, I mean, look, there's a lot of sexual kind of either innuendo or just kind of suggestion violence throughout this film. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I picked up on was while Enchantress is doing her hoodoo voodoo magic, whatever it is, she's shaking her hips, and I'm like, nah,
Shakira.
Yeah, I've seen Harry Potter.
Nope.
I've seen Harry Potter, and he does nothing with his hips. He does everything with his hand, right? He's got a wand, or he does something with his hand, and that's usually kind of what you do, right?
It doesn't
come from the hips. It comes from the hands.
No, man, the magic is in the muffin. I don't know. I was trying to come up with a funny phrase, but I couldn't. I mean, you know, if one's milkshake could considerably bring boys to the yard, then why not also bring rocks into the sky and fire and destruction to all of mankind?
Oh, what?
I don't know. Oh, man.
I don't know. There's a lot of problems because something like that, my question becomes, like, is that ethnically insensitive because she appears to be doing, like, a primitive rain dance type of thing? Or is it just sexist because you've got a pretty woman who's writhing in chains and...
Why can't it be
spangles?
Both?
It could be both.
Maybe it's both.
Maybe they went for the gold and they tried to do both. Why is she still an attractive woman while her brother is the monster from the end of the first Thor movie?
I will say this. I actually liked him. Yeah, the Doom... what is that guy's name?
Incubus.
No. The Doomsday thing. Destructor or something like that.
Yeah, it was something dumb like that.
Anyways, one thing that I did find that I actually liked was when he uses his powers and he slaps stuff, whether it's metal, whether it's a plane out of the sky or whatever, he leaves this kind of residue where it looks like something was shot out of a flamethrower and just melted everything in like jagged edges. And I was like, okay, I'm into that. Like bravo.
In this lazy movie, that one piece of production design really stuck out.
Yeah. His whole form is kind of interesting. Cool.
Yeah. Yep. Until he becomes one of the samurai creatures from Sucker Punch.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But I mean, it's just funny because like, they're like, oh, we have to bring these people in to help fight this. But then they just blow everything up.
Yeah.
You know, none of these people have superpowers. So it just be like, why couldn't they launch a missile?
I don't know.
Like,
because that would have made too much sense.
It's a fucking explosive the size of a dinner plate, and it murders that incubus guy. And then a satchel bomb takes out the entire thingamabob. But I guess at that point they've sort of hurt Enchantress enough. Because
we didn't even talk about
Katana.
Oh man!
Remember her when she literally jumps on to the end of the first act and says, "Don't forget about me." And then she gets a flashback.
Yeah.
Mm. And her sword holds the soul of her dead husband,
which is her only characteristic.
And everyone's like, "Cool, whatever, fuck it, I don't know." I mean, there's so many problems, and the fact that the Joker is like, have you ever been out like having fun with friends and then you have that one friend who just texts you every now and then and you're like, this person's obviously going through their own shit right now and I don't have time for their story to be a part of mine tonight? Like, that's the Joker literally in this movie, because he is constantly texting Harley.
It's like, come on guys, what about me?
Yeah, I'm coming for you. I'm close. It's like, what? Shut up.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but like at the end of the movie, or not even at the end of the movie, but he deactivated her neck thing. But then later on when Rick smashes his thing, she's acting like, oh, I'm free. And it's like, you already were.
Well, yeah. I will say this. It is interesting, and I actually appreciated it. I didn't necessarily like who they did it to, but they have all these like small rice bombs, I guess, in their necks, and it's to corral them and bring them under control. And you know, it would be interesting if the entire film was kind of what Boomerang was saying, where it's just a control mechanism. It's all in your mind. It's not actually real.
Yeah, like they didn't actually do it.
Yeah. So what do they do?
Slipknot.
They test it, and you're like, uh-oh, because you know that they actually did this, right? Like, you know that this is something that's real, and so there's not a lot of drama on your end, except you just don't know whether they're actually going to pull that trigger. And sure enough, mm-hmm. they pull that trigger, and it was a pretty big gasp on my behalf. I would say most of this film is very predictable. That one moment I was kind of caught a little bit off guard by, and that is kind of Ayer sneaking into this film, right? That's kind of his aesthetic, is, hey, I'm not just gonna show that this guy dies off screen. I'm literally gonna have his hanging corpse hit a glass screen, and I'm gonna show it.
But
and his head
question.
Is missing.
When you have a movie where literally everyone gets at least one flashback,
mm-hmm.
and then you out of nowhere introduce another character,
also Rand,
who doesn't get a flashback, what are the odds that that character is going to survive to the end of the movie?
What are also the odds that that guy happens to be Native American?
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
And gets less than 10 lines of dialogue.
And let's not forget Jay Hernandez as Diablo is a gangbanger who has I guess he only loses control once. He doesn't seem to have a history of spousal abuse. And when he does, it murders everyone.
I think it was Monica Castillo who wrote really well about that problem, specifically pointing out if you start really taking some of these characters beat for beat, especially the female characters and the minorities, they are just a coagulation of racist and sexist stereotypes.
It's funny because you say that, and in my head, the only thing I can think of that's not one of those in terms of characters is Rick Flagg. Right? Well, I guess Captain Boomerang, because Australia doesn't count as a minority. But, this movie, there's a difference in representation.
Sure.
Between diversity of a cast and the optics of that cast. So this is a great movie for representation in terms of simple diversity. Mm-hmm. In terms of optics, it is an ongoing nightmare from which there is no escape.
And I don't think this one is even fascinating in the way that something like End of Watch is fascinating. Like, I think End of Watch, after watching this movie, I kept thinking about, okay, is how the women are treated in this, which, aside from one scene that seems literally ripped from Hateful Eight, is it that much different than other Ayer films? And I was thinking specifically of how End of Watch, it's not great with its characterization, but it's very egalitarian. You know, as much as you had in that film, you had Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña, they're the women in that film. Like, you had a actresses like America Ferrera and I'm forgetting her partner.
And Anna Kendrick.
Oh, and Anna Kendrick as well, who is a girlfriend character, but still, given interiority.
Is it Michelle Rodriguez in this?
No, it's America Ferrera, I think, is the character. Yeah. But anyways, I guess the point I'm trying to get at is, Ayers would approach them, in a completely equal way, for better or for worse. And even, if there were characters who, even if there were characters who are minorities and seem to be entirely defined by, their criminal lifestyle, he was balancing it out with, good guys and bad guys who are coming from both sides of
optics. Because anyone can come from anywhere.
Sure.
As we learned in Ratatouille.
And so, but, like, he also wasn't stooping to sexual violence for easy stuff. And it's weird that this PG-13 movie is arguably has like a lot more gross, you
a
know,
woman is
sexual violence
tortured into being a superhero.
Sure.
Harley Quinn. I mean, like, I don't even know what to make of her backstory in this.
Although I know that I did see one writer, shoot, it might have been Roth Cornett from HitFix. Maybe I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. She was talking about, even when the first trailer came out, how she was worried that they were going to let down Harley Quinn, because in the trailer it looks like Joker pushes her into the vats, mm-hmm. which is not the case. But that also comes right after a scene where, as you're saying, where, yeah, that's the scene where he says, "I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to hurt you really, really bad."
Right,
so it's like,
I mean, I've loved Batman the Animated Series as mm-hmm. a child after I got over hating it for no reason, really. Like, growing up, mm-hmm. for me, was the act of learning how awesome Batman the Animated Series was.
For sure.
So, like, as a young child, I didn't like it. And then as, like, a 9-year-old, I was like, wait, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And Harley Quinn and her relationship, for lack of a more correct descriptor, with the Joker was a big part of that.
Yeah.
Because it's very obvious that they have a terrible relationship, and even Poison Ivy tells her that, and mm-hmm. you see the damage in this woman, but you also understand where she's coming from. And in this movie, she's already under his thrall. He gets her to bring him a machine gun, and you know, at that point, you should probably stop. Like, you don't have to question her devotion to you anymore.
Sure.
Because
sure.
I'm married, yeah. and I'm pretty sure if I asked my wife for a machine gun, she'd balk. but that's fine, because I don't need one. And but in this movie, he like repays her for that with torturing her,
yeah,
in some way. And then we see him talking her into jumping into a vat of acid,
I guess.
And then
maybe,
and
also
then
the common scene,
yeah, the common scene, yeah, handing her off like a treat. I think I couldn't
well, no,
tell.
No, that happens after. That happens after.
Well, that is, okay. Yes. But I mean, I couldn't tell if that was the Joker trying to be like, is this guy going to disrespect me and take my woman? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, then she kind of says, like, I make my own choices and I'm totally down with being pimped out. I mean, it's just that it doesn't feel like they ever picked a tact, and they're just like, let's just show her in a variety of different situations so everyone can be offended. And we can never really give a clear concept of her character and where she's coming from.
And they could have picked one of those for a coherent narrative. But right. but as you're saying, they just wanted it all.
Right. And it's not like they ever engage with that to like make you think that maybe she's not a bad person. Maybe she's just fallen in with a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because at the end, their reunion is a triumph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is nuts. Like, you should feel bad at the end of this movie, because there should have been some character growth. And she even asked Deadshot, like, you know, have you ever been in love? And she mentions how important that is to her.
Sure.
And then she has that weird dream where they're both normal. But, like, at this point, she, if she is truly the arbiter of her own destiny, should want them to be together as weird. Because mm-hmm. being together normally would be what her pre-rape trauma self would want, which makes it even darker that she still wants that. Because
mm-hmm.
it's yeah. like she thinks that by doing this and being crazy and acting this way, she will maybe somehow pull him to the middle.
Sure.
I don't know.
So dark to contemplate. And then
again, I don't even want her to be a good, I don't need her to be a good character. I don't mean good in terms of well-written. I mean good
as in terms of moral.
Yeah. No, yeah. I don't need that at all. But you can't, again, you can't have it both ways and give hints that, you know, it's just so strange that Amanda Waller refers to these characters as, you know, serial killers and psychopaths. And, you know, I'm not saying that, like, the weird thing that came to me is, like, you know, besides for the brief flashbacks we get at the beginning, which are, you know, edited to be incredibly stylized and don't really get across the violence, like, we are getting brief dialogue mentions where it shows that these characters have obviously killed people before and things like that, but it's all just lines of dialogue that have no bearing on our overall understanding of these characters.
Right. Yeah, nothing that is said or done by these people really syncs up to with what we're being told to think about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a major problem. It's, you know, that's the problem from whence everything else springs.
Mm-hmm.
That, and that we're apparently supposed to sort of care about Rick Flagg and Dr. June Moon.
Mm-mm.
Even though we see them together in two scenes, and in one of them they kind of sort of make out, and in the other one he is eating a chicken wing while staring out a window.
I don't understand why it was a chicken wing.
It might have been a rib. Maybe it was a rib.
No, it was definitely a chicken wing. I could tell.
Okay.
The way he was gnawing at it, he was being very careful. He was not just like gnawing at the outside edges. He was
right,
like, here's
those
like
bones. Yeah,
exactly. Here's another one of those. Oop. Yep. Oh man.
Know.
Oh
it's
man.
Such a dim, depressing film to have to watch.
Why is Batman in this movie?
Crossover appeal? I don't know.
Branding,
yeah. So that you actually feel like it's part of the same universe, I guess.
What was Batman doing?
He caught people.
During all this other crazy stuff.
Oh, well, I mean, he's not in Midway City. He's in Gotham.
He's got a plane.
I don't know where Midway City is, Bill.
I don't either.
Apparently Chicago, essentially.
And what is it? Gotham is Jersey City and Metropolis is New York?
Yeah.
Which is just fucking dumb.
Sure. Sure.
Wait, guys, I still have no sense of what the Joker was doing at Van Chris, or is that what it's called? Like, what serum or injection was he?
He was finding out how to deactivate the neck bombs.
Yep.
That's what he was doing?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yep. He got Ike Barinholtz on his payroll because he bought his gambling debt.
Sure.
And Ike Barinholtz is like, this is the deal. This is what's going on. They're gonna fucking shoot a bomb into her neck. And, you know, we get it from Van Chris Enterprises, which is a division of Wayne Corp.
Yep. You know, I don't know about the comic, whether my guess is Joker is not someone who can be tamed to be on a team like this. But I just don't understand why the script was conceived.
No, he's not. Part of the classic formation of the Suicide Squad. Because
I mean, I don't know anything about the Suicide Squad.
This is not a classic formation as far as my...
No, because it's got Harley in it.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, there's a classic formation, and then there's, like, the current one that they actually put in, like, the current comic has Harley, and it has a lot of these other characters, but that current comic came out before this film was ever in production, so it wasn't like it was an answer to this and to just give the fans a bone. It was legitimately something else that they've done, but a lot of people have a lot of issues specifically with how Harley is represented in that comic book. But yeah, a lot of people have been like, well, why isn't Joker part of it? And the whole point is that this is not A-list characters. This is the C-team, right?
Why isn't he more of a threat to the team?
Absolutely.
Like, he doesn't give a shit about any of them except for Harley.
And
so
that's
he should
the,
be
that's
on
the
board
issue?
To murder all of them. And that should be his plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that incredibly limp scene where Harley is, you know, rescued, for lack of a better word, and then maybe he dies, which, you know, you don't believe for half a second. But
no,
you know,
oh my God. No. Like,
that whole helicopter scene is so limp, especially, I mean, not only it almost works with the character moment with Will Smith, just because they're the two characters we've got to know the most throughout the entire film, but...
I think that the movie would have been more interesting if they had, like, played up a romance between the two of them. Just, like, to be completely honest with you, like, if he had...
Mm-hmm.
If he had shown her something like a common, caring relationship... Like, because the Joker left her behind in a car to drown to death. So if he had had a mirror moment where he refuses to leave her behind, even though the danger is much graver... And then if she... had shown him that, like, you know, a woman, he can't be pissed off at his ex-wife because he was never going to be able to pull off a relationship with a normal woman. Mm-hmm. Then they might have built each other mutually, and then when the Joker showed up, it could have not only been a physical threat but an emotional one. There I go writing movies again.
Yep.
But that would have been something. That would have been
that interesting. Makes too much damn sense. Too much damn sense.
Guys, I think one thing we're picking up on too is that, you know, that Brian needs to move to Hollywood, but also that even scenes that, you know, they're not ambiguous, but it's the film is so choppy and poorly defined in its character motivations and its plot convolutions that we are actually questioning, you know, what was going on in any individual scene.
Right.
I think this is just even more representative of, you know, just how much this script has, you know, gone through a guillotine. Yep. Or not a guillotine.
Yeah, pretty much. Or shredder?
Yeah. Shredder.
A guillotine would have been much more simple.
Yeah,
and
that's
probably
right. That'd be clean.
You could still tell what it was. I don't know. It's just,
yeah, this,
again,
this
it's just,
puts it through
so
the
much.
Through the Ghostbuster shredder, right? That thing?
The ghost shredder.
Yes.
Oh, God. Yeah, pretty much.
And I just want to say, Brian, you started to get into it as speculation, but where do you guys think the reshoots were?
I honestly don't know. I really can't tell because
here's the
like,
thing:
this movie is so shoddily put together, anyways.
Right,
that I'm
it's not
like
there's a scene that it feels like the budget was less because like everything was so empty and so samey. And so like usually if there were a point where like you cut to two characters talking in a broom closet. And
sure.
Like, here, have some exposition that explains my character, and also let's tell some jokes. Like, then I'd be like, okay, there it is.
So it's the bar scene, but that's like the most Ayer scene ever.
Yeah, it is. And
okay, go ahead.
I don't know.
Okay. So one thing I want to bring up real quick, probably one of the last big issues I had was they keep these rock monster things, whatever you want to call them. They keep grabbing Flag and they keep dragging him away. And it's this big mystery. It's treated as this big mystery and nobody's actually commenting on it. They just keep rescuing him because
they
feel
Flag
like
again.
Yeah. They got Flag again. And you're just like, what?
So
and it's so obvious because we know about Kara and mm-hmm. and his relationship with
Bill,
Dr. Moon.
June Moon.
Dr. Moon. Calling her Dr. Moon.
Dr. June Moon.
No.
June Moon.
What kind of doctor falls into a Mayan temple and then rips the head off of a fetish item she finds?
I don't know.
She's an archaeologist.
She didn't watch enough Indiana Jones. All right.
This goes along with the Prometheus thing that I had a problem with, where it was like every scientist is the worst scientist because it's like, oh, look at this thing. Let me rip it in half and see what that does.
What was the movie where someone leans over something that looks like the alien egg? It was Stranger Things. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's a moment in Stranger Things where they literally come upon something that looks like the alien egg in Alien. And they peer over it, and you're like, no, don't. Why are you doing that? Why?
It's
why
10 years after Alien, too. You'd think they would have seen it.
Stranger Things season 2.
Yeah. I don't know. They keep dragging Flag away, and it becomes so obvious why they're doing this. Mm-hmm. And yet, nothing actually happens from that. Like,
It's not like he gets caught and then they're like, we have to save him or we're going to die.
No, they say that a couple of times.
No, but I'm saying like he never gets successfully taken.
Sure.
Like it'd be more interesting if he gets taken and they're like, we have to go into this nest of vipers.
Uh-huh.
And that's why they end up saving the world is because they're just trying to save themselves.
Well, but I'm just curious, what is Enchantress trying to do there?
She misses her boyfriend.
Enchantress doesn't give a shit about this dude.
Well, she got laid out of it. I mean,
Enchantress didn't.
I think it's less a plot thing, and I think it's more that the film is trying to show some sense of, you know, confliction between these characters. I really didn't get a sense that it was as plot motivated as you guys, although that certainly makes sense. But I just think it was the film trying to be like, oh, look, they're so, you know, they feel so conflicted about being bad.
You're talking about Enchantress? Yeah. In that moment?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Well, okay. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's not like Enchantress shows up and if she had successfully taken him, we might have an answer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it seems to be like she knows him and she either wants to turn him into a coal monster to have a good fighter, but like her people become pretty good fighters immediately anyway, or it's her saying like, join me and become king of the universe.
Sure.
And yeah, like that would have been interesting, especially
a fun movie.
What was that?
That would have been a fun movie.
Right. Well, if she had gotten him and then they were like, we have to go and destroy this thing and save Flag because if his vitals decline, then we all die. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time that they're trying to get him, he's there being seduced by his girlfriend, Dr. June Moon / Enchantress, who's like, what has being good gotten you? It's gotten you in charge of a bunch of monsters. You know, you fought so hard to put people like that away and now you're babysitting them, like, join me, be bad. And then at the end of the movie, he does.
Yeah, why did you get that last beat?
He becomes the villain. And then they have to take him down, or he escapes and he becomes a new villain. And it's like, ooh, now this is interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's still what bugged me.
Well, but, I mean, at the very least, what they could have done was have the rock monsters kind of whisper to him.
Rock
maybe
monster.
In the voice, maybe in the voice of Dr. June. Or something along those lines, where they could have just like given more of a reason than just all these things keep grabbing him and taking him away. And they finally, at one moment, they literally surround him, like not like, oh, kind of. No, they are arm in arm with him. Mm-hmm. And they're like no, we're protecting you now. And you're just like, this is absurd.
The funny thing is that in that moment, I was on board because I was like, this is going to be super interesting because now they are openly saying we have to join up just to keep this guy alive, to keep ourselves alive.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I wanted more of that selfishness. Like, there was none.
Yeah.
Like, aside from, like, one aborted escape attempt early in the movie and then them just saying they were bad guys.
And Harley getting taxed, that joke is on the way.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God. All right. Is there anything else to say about this movie? I feel like we've eviscerated it pretty well.
How was she getting text messages when that satellite was destroyed?
I think that happened after she got her texts.
I don't know.
Maybe she was on ground-based Wi-Fi.
do you guys think we're going to get a director's cut of this?
So
like
that's one of the
BBS
things.
BBS DOJ UE?
Yeah,
well, I was just reading something and someone was saying that this is actually the director's cut. Like,
no,
like,
what I heard was that this was the compromise cut and that he just agreed to it. So they didn't force this cut on him, but he consented to it because it got a better reaction in test screenings.
Then more than likely, they're never going to do anything with the director's cut.
Right.
That's good. Yeah.
It's kind of like Martin Scorsese with Gangs of New York.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got an abridged cut, but he has gone on record saying, like, nope, that's it. I'm not going to do director's cuts.
What was Snyder's response to after BVS in terms of the director's cut? Like, was the director's cut something that was long? No, that was after the film came out and bombed. Well,
yeah,
critically bombed. That
well,
there was
after Deadpool,
cut, right?
After Deadpool came out and made a lot of money, they said, hey, we're going to release an R-rated director's cut.
Ah.
And so they didn't make it seem like it was a reaction to the bad press and reviews that the movie got. They made it seem like, ooh, this is what the fans want, and we're going to give it to them.
Okay.
Yep, pretty much.
Yep. So what? We've talked about poor plotting, ugly cinematography, sexism, racism. Is there anything else that we need to talk about this movie?
Should we talk about what this means for DC? I know it's the big conversation.
Why couldn't Harley put on some pants?
Because she didn't want to. Honestly, she made that choice in the movie, and I'm fine with it. I think that her character obviously is very open and comfortable with her sexuality, and that's fine. That's not the problem I had. My problem was the camera. following her ass
exactly,
so lovingly.
Exactly.
So yeah. I don't need her to put on pants. I don't need a woman to do anything that she doesn't want to do. I need the director of this film to not use that as an excuse to stare up the crack of Margot Robbie's ass.
I wasn't feeling that bay gaze to the same level as you guys. I will agree that there's a gaze there, but like I don't know. I must be crazy because I,
you know, it's weird.
I found Joker more sexual than Harley, honestly.
Well, that's the weird thing. She doesn't feel, she feels sexy without being sexual.
Sure.
If you were to point out the two of them and say, which of these two people has had more sex? I pointed the Joker. Because I'll be honest, like Margot Robbie, for all of the fetishistic touches that make her seem as though she's a sex object in this movie,
sure,
she doesn't feel like a person who's ever had sex.
Absolutely.
Which is a bigger problem.
Yeah, she felt like a demented version of like Shirley Temple to me at times.
Oof.
Yep.
Oof.
Okay.
Right.
That weirds me out.
I was about to say I'm
well,
gonna end
I
it now.
Didn't mean it like yeah, no, oh, okay.
No. I mean it works. It works.
No, it's true. Like, that's a good way to put it.
I'm just really creeped out by that situation now.
Sure. Within context, it's not great.
No. Yeah.
All right.
What were you gonna? You were gonna say something, Brian?
About what?
What do you mean about this movie?
I
mean,
Bill, I already said that this movie was a quagmire of things that I could say, so it's hard for me to know exactly what
Before,
were we talking about.
The state of DC?
It's like impossible to know because they've already. Here's the thing. DC has put out a list of like 7 movies that they're going to make, and they've already given them air dates and everything is all set.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they pull an Allegiant and suddenly scale back and say, we're not releasing it in theaters, we're going to have a TV movie and then a series.
Sure.
I don't see that happening, especially because DC already has what are apparently some very good television shows.
Mm-hmm. They do, yeah.
So
I like Supergirl a lot. I'm a fan of some of the seasons of Arrow, and The Flash is kicking all sorts of ass right now.
And then they've got that other one, like
the World of Tomorrow. Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
World of Tomorrow is a fantastic film.
Yeah.
Not what we're talking about. Emily Prime is the best superhero on Earth. Oh man.
Wait, is it Justice League and Wonder Woman next, or is it Wonder Woman next?
I think it's Wonder Woman and then
Justice League,
and then Aquaman is afterwards.
So here's
and then there's a Batman or two coming out.
At some point, there's an Aquaman. At some point, there's a Flash, and at some point, there's a Cyborg. I think mm-hmm. maybe actually Cyborg got folded into Justice League, and they're just gonna do his origin story and everything there. But. One thing I want to mention that was kind of hilarious is I don't know about y'all, but I saw this movie in the middle of the day Friday after work. I got off early and I was just like, okay, time to see it. Here we go. And my theater was packed middle of the day Friday. I am talking about a 1:50 showing. I was looking around. I was like, what are you Yahoos doing here? I'm off work right now.
Yahoos?
Yeah.
Maybe they're college students who are off for the summer, Bill.
No, there were some grown ass adults in that theater. I really hope they didn't take the day off to go watch this movie. But
considering it made on Friday $65 million.
It's a pretty good haul.
Yeah. That was domestic. And then it made close to the same foreign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sitting at like 100. Yeah,
130.
Okay, 29. The theater and
it's at 146 million at this point.
Oh, because have they released Saturday now?
Yeah, at 8 a.m.
Okay.
And so, like, I also went to another theater, the Alamo near me, and last night. And again, I almost couldn't park in the theater's parking lot. I was going to the bar upstairs, blah, 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 blah. But I almost couldn't get into the parking lot because it was so packed. So, like, this movie, I guess, has a ton of interest in it, but...
For all the reasons that we said, I mean, like, this is an inherently interesting idea for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, it sold itself as this, like just look at the fucking poster, and it's like, mm-hmm. oh my god, look at those colors.
That's a crazy type of movie that you want to see, and then you get fucking awfulness.
Yeah, soot monsters.
Bleak, unfunny, uncolorful, joyless massacre of time and talent. Put that on the fucking poster.
Quote it. But no, it was funny because one of the few things that I was really looking forward to was catching the Wonder Woman and the Justice League trailer. And I showed up too late to catch those. And so I was very upset with my day yesterday.
Understandably.
Bill, what was your response like in your theater? Because I have to say, my theater was pretty damn quiet through the whole movie.
Same. It was pretty quiet.
The biggest response was when Will Smith was on top of that police car.
Mm.
That was about it.
Are you talking about when he's like just mowing down?
He's doing his John Wick thing.
Yeah. Okay, fine. I'll admit that was one of the cooler sequences. That was probably one.
I wouldn't say sequences. I would say shot within a sequence.
Sure.
Because if you said sequence, you'd mean that entire assault, and that was a fucking nightmare.
Meh. Whatever you want to call it. That 1 minute of action beat was pretty satisfying. Beyond that, no.
Well, I'm just looking forward to the Ike Barinholtz spinoff movie in the DC Extended Universe.
Guys, I just want to... I'm thinking more about this, and, like, you know, I like Will Smith. I know that's where a lot of the praise is going, but I think, honestly, I think it's been so long since we've seen Will Smith in a movie where he just literally got to, you know, really exude charisma and really be that movie star.
I
feel like Focus was pitching itself as that, but I never saw Focus.
I never saw it either.
I mean, I don't know if I'd really call his character even that well developed. He just, you know, he nails those punchlines, and
I mean, a movie star can make good. Like that work, and he's a movie star.
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's the end of our review/discussion/ whatever you want to fucking call this about the suicide. Oh, it's not the Suicide Squad. It's just Suicide Squad.
Quit doing that.
My issue with the Deathmate article arouses again. What was that?
He's back with Ayer for Bright. Will Smith this.
Well, that could be good. I mean, who knows? I'm still interested in Ayer. I'm still interested in Smith and Roby. This hasn't deadened my enthusiasm for any of these artists or actors, but I mean, like, Jesus.
Well, maybe it's confirmed Scott Eastwood and what's his name, Boomerang. Boomerang.
Jai Courtney?
Yeah, they just... Actually, you know what? Fine.
Wait, Scott Eastwood in this movie?
Yes.
Wasn't he in the Rodeo movie? Yes, Longest he was ride. As well. Yes. along with Britt Roberson. God rest her soul. Because she's in movie jail, though.
Oh, because she was in Tomorrowland, too, wasn't she?
Yes, she was, and that movie did nothing.
No, that's sad, because that movie had potential.
Anyways, what was I going to say? I actually kind of like Jai Courtney in this movie. That's
unicorn fetish.
I don't understand. Yeah, they didn't have to keep that. They really didn't have to keep that from the comics.
All right. Well, that's it for our Suicide Squad review. Here we have now my brief interview with Nick Newman and Danny King to celebrate the 200th episode of the Film Stage Show. So here we are to celebrate 200 glorious episodes. We have, for the first time in a long time, the original trio that began this marvelous enterprise. We have Nick Newman.
Hello.
And the indomitable Danny King.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you.
So we're here just to have a conversation, talk about the beginnings of this insane enterprise, and to see where you two are now, because as time has gone on, though I have remained mired in the production of this show week to week, you two have spread your wings and gone on to bigger and greater things. So, let's just start there. Nick Newman, we've heard from you every now and then. Danny King, it has been far too long. What the hell are you doing with your life now?
Yeah, I don't know if it's bigger and greater things. It's more just busier things, you know. Got the 5-day a week grind.
Yeah.
Over at the Village Voice, working as their calendar editor.
That's what does that entail?
So I kind of like write or assign and edit various blurbs on things that are going on in the city. So if you're in New York and you want something to do, you can check out the Village Voice calendar, and there will probably be a movie recommendation, perhaps a concert recommendation, stuff like that. And I do still do, you know, some film writing on the side, but I don't have as much time anymore to see, you know, some movies that I normally would. I'm trying to think of a recent example, but like definitely a lot of the more blockbuster type movies from this year that I might have seen in another year, I haven't really seen.
So what's the biggest blockbuster that you've seen this year? Or have you not been able to get any?
I've seen Born.
Oh, that you made time for that one.
Born was a shocking film.
Yes, it was a stunning expose on our modern connected world.
Post Snowden. Yeah, that was a weird movie, but I did see it.
Okay.
Yeah. Night of Cups was great.
Okay, there we go. We found some common ground again.
Midnight Special was very good.
What would you say is your favorite film this year so far?
Maybe Night of Cups or Midnight Special.
All right, fantastic.
The Shallows was good, though. We would have had
a good
banter about that.
That's actually, I'm super excited to speak to Nick Newman about that. So let's pivot to Nick Newman. Nick Newman, what have you been up to?
Let's establish up front that I did not see The Shallows.
What?
But we can still talk about it.
What?
I know. Nick. Yeah, it just didn't happen. I will
after
see it.
After you nearly put Nonstop on your top 10.
Yeah, it just, it, the timing of it was, oh, it just didn't happen. It'll happen at some point. Before year's end. For top 10 consideration. So by the end of the year, it'll really, you know, the difference will be negligible when it's at, you know, at least number 4 on my top 10.
I should certainly hope so.
Yeah. What have I been up to? I mean, I'm still with the film stage full time.
Yes.
Really. Although I suppose I'm with it full time in name more so than effort, because I, well, let's see, when was the last time I was here? Was it for Night of Cups?
Yes, I guess. I believe it was.
Which really wasn't that long ago. That was maybe 5 months total, if that even. But there have been some decent size changes in the time since. I have started interning for this new distribution company called Grasshopper Film, which is sort of, how would I describe it? I mean, it, basically the idea is to distribute the best in film from all over the world. That's the main goal of it. If you're familiar with Cinema Guild, this is run by the guy who used to be their director of theatrical distribution. So, you know, basically going from one of the best film distributors in the world to what will, with time, become one of the best film distributors in the world. I've been doing that there. I don't want to talk about the details of it too much because it's still sort of a... I haven't actually announced it really much on social media, but that's been something I've been doing. It's very exciting. It's actually exactly the kind of thing I want to do.
That does sound like envy-inducingly awesome.
Yeah. It's really cool. I mean, you know, there is a lot of just standard office work to be done there of, you know, printing shipping labels and going to the UPS truck and that kind of thing. I've rolled more posters in the past 2 months than I ever had in my life, than I may have in
three previous lifetimes combined, actually. but, you know, it's, you know, I'm rolling posters for really good movies, aren't I? and I'm sending them out to very fine theatrical institutions and academic circles, et cetera, et cetera. That's been very exciting. You know, hopefully that'll continue and blossom into a full-time job. You know, I'm living in New York City full-time now. I will give out my address on the show.
Oh, why not?
Let's just be clear. If you want my address and you want to mail me things regularly, some sweets and treats and goods, can provide it off air. Otherwise,
slide into his DMs.
Slide into my DMs. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of been the thrust of it. Should I go into the nitty-gritty details of my personal life on the show? Should I talk about my recent romantic interests and pursuals and experiences?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, let's be real. When I began this, I had one girlfriend, and through this whole thing, through 200 episodes, I have gone through a bitter, angry, physically violent breakup, and then I found a woman who is the love of my life, who I have married, and we now have a house and a child. So there's been big changes.
Wow.
Yeah.
You went from beating your girlfriend, apparently, to having a wife and child.
Yes, absolutely. No, like many people, I was not the aggressor, which is super weird to talk about, honestly. But
well, yeah, I thought you were gonna say when we started, I had one girlfriend, and now I have six wives. I have many women.
Technically, we're all married to Jesus, but yes.
Wow.
So did you actually want to get into the nitty gritty of your stuff? Are you in a relationship now?
Oh no, that's absolutely.
Who the hell would date you?
Well, that's a question. It's a question I ask myself a lot. So. If we want to discuss that, maybe we can crack this one open.
I was gonna say, though, like, you know, mine would probably be marriage and fatherhood, but what are the biggest changes in your life that have happened on a personal level from the first time we sat down to talk about Cabin in the Woods to right now?
Losing my virginity, does that count?
yeah, did that actually happen?
It finally did. With enough discussion, you know, laid out a contract, made some
addendums.
No, we laid out the financial collateral of the situation.
Okay.
There was that. You know, I was a freshman in college at the time. I've since graduated. I'm actually currently living with a friend of mine from college who I would not meet for almost a year and a half. After the first episode is recorded, and now we are living together in the real world, you know, that's definitely a change. That's definitely a shifting of the tide.
What about you, Danny?
I did not lose my virginity to this friend.
Okay. Did you lose your virginity to this podcast, though? Was it playing in the background?
I'll just say that our Amazing Spider-Man review is more interesting to me than most other people.
Okay.
Dear Lord.
Danny King, what is the biggest personal change in your life?
Oh, man.
You finally lost all your baby teeth.
I lost all my baby teeth. I still have my wisdom teeth.
Yeah, I don't know mine. I don't think I'm ever going to get rid of those.
Yeah, I guess the half of what Nick said about living in the real world and paying for things like rent and, you know, gotta put a rent check in the envelope every month.
I do it for the mortgage.
I do it for the mortgage and I do it for the country.
Well, that's good. Glad to see your sense of patriotism is intact.
I guess maybe this would be the most extreme change. You know, I've been living in New York for like 5 years now, so that's kind of been a constant for me. Yeah.
So not much at all has changed in Danny's life.
No. Actually not. I'm not being like, I'm just being honest, you know?
No,
you know, it's funny, last time I saw Danny, I actually ran into him at the Village Voice's own Four Knots Music Festival.
Oh, yeah.
We just, like, ran into each other there, and he just seemed like very much the same Danny.
Danny is ageless and changeless.
I'm pretty sure he was wearing... Like, I'm pretty sure I've seen him wear those clothes before. Like, it's just, you know, just looking the same, looking like a charmer as ever.
You know what's hilarious? Because I go to New York often, and every time I go, Jordan's like, let me know the next time you go to New York, we should hang out. And for some reason, even though I go 3 to 4 times a year, they're always the times when he's not around.
Oh, man.
So I have yet to meet in person a single person that I worked with on the film stage.
When's your next trip?
Oh, I don't know. Probably Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Thanksgiving, I mean, probably out of town.
Yeah, Thanksgiving, people tend to go out of town. But
I just saw Jordan at a screening of Hell or High Water.
Was that good? I'm planning on seeing
it. Yeah, I liked it. Yeah, you probably like it.
Fantastic. All right. Well, what else is there? What other big things have happened? Or is that really it? Are we just here to talk? Are we going to be like boring friends from high school who meet after so long and can only talk about their jobs and then slowly drift away again?
Well, what about the podcast? What do you think it?
Oh, the podcast. It's gone through some stuff. We no longer do a discussion topic at the opening. We no longer talk about what's coming out later on at the end because the reviews were becoming just unwieldy and gargantuan. We now have sponsorship by MUBI, which is pretty awesome. And Danny, it's impossible for me every time I have to say MUBI not to say MUBI because of that one time that you fucked that up.
Did I knew it though, right? I knew I said it wrong, or did I?
No, you didn't.
Nah, okay.
You said it wrong, and then you said, "Wait, I don't think that's right."
That was actually, if we want to mark down like profound life changes, because now it's just like MUBI second nature. I would never say.
Well, that was way back. That was like 4 years ago.
Yeah,
Nick Newman. We don't have a lot of people saying things hilariously wrong. Candela.
Wow. Yes. I thought you were talking about my opinions, but that'll,
yeah, that's what I thought.
That'll do as well.
No, we still have a lot of people with wrong opinions.
Yeah.
And, we have the roundtable every other week where we basically cram 3 discussion topics together and then just, hash those things out.
So I'm realizing now that I was wrong. The last time I was here to discuss The Lobster, which really wasn't that long ago. That was all of 2 months, right?
Yes.
That was late May. So it reminds me, because I had said there after the recording that I would be happy to join for a TFS roundtable. Maybe we shouldn't hash out business on air, but if you have some sort of Google Doc or whatever of schedules and topics, send that my way.
All right.
I mean, if you want to.
Well, of course. I mean, I've dragged you all here for this. I'd love to drag you back for another thing. I thought you were going to pull a To the Wonder and tell me that suddenly you loved The Lobster.
No, no. That'll never happen. How's the kid? You have a child? Is it a boy or is it a girl?
It is a girl. Her name is Cora, and she
is
as good as a baby can be.
Don't gender the child.
But we're trying not to put labels on it, you know. Cora's like a placeholder, and then when she learns to speak, we're gonna let her find her own identity and her own self. And then, no, she is a girl. She is named Cora, and that's just 2 things she's gonna have to live with until she's, oh, I don't know, 18.
And do you spoil her?
Things on. No, it's really hard to spoil a 5-week-old Danny.
Yeah,
because at this point, they don't have any will. They're basically know that they're uncomfortable, know that they're tired, or know that they're hungry, and so you have to meet those needs. It was funny though. She loves watching the ceiling fan that we just installed in our living room, and she woke up in the carrier the other day in the living room and was staring at the unmoving ceiling fan. And I said to my wife, "The ceiling fan isn't moving. I wonder if she knows what disappointment is yet." So that's the kind of environment my child is going to be raised
in. I love
it. And I'm super excited to...
Does she interact with the Huskies?
She a little bit.
Okay.
In her baby way. She will swing an arm out at them. And luckily, both the dogs are pretty cool with that for the moment. Lana actually believes that the child is her own. She is so weirdly present and protective that at some point we're probably just going to have to sit her down and, you know, tell her that she's a human.
That's going to be a tough one.
It's going to be heartbreaking, honestly.
The idea of keeping a child, particularly a small newborn one, near two dogs. Like, if I had a newborn child, that would terrify me.
It was,
like, nothing.
It was... I have seen one of my dogs deal with children before, and she is a delight. Mm-hmm. She, my wife calls her, like, Nana from Peter Pan. The other one was a wild card, but, you know, we did the whole bring her in, introduce them slowly, and now they both love her and then just kind of forget that she's around in equal measure. So it's great.
Yeah.
But yeah. And somehow, in spite of all that, and with the help of my wonderful wife, I'm still able to see movies and do this show, which allowed me to do a nearly hour and 45 minute long episode on Suicide Squad.
Jesus.
There's a lot of wrong stuff to talk about in that movie. It's a nightmare.
No, I'm sure.
Indeed. All right. Yeah. Well, anything else that you guys would like to say to our listening public before we say goodbye for now?
I've never stopped thinking about you, listening public.
That's adorable. In fact, Nick, they've never stopped thinking about you. We just got a review that told me that I had to ditch my boring co-hosts, and it specifically name-checked Amanda and you.
Nice.
So, your shadow looms long.
I wonder, did they explain what constitutes boring, or...
It's probably just you don't agree with them.
Okay. I would think that's more interesting, but... I don't know.
I mean, that's what I think. I think some of the best episodes are the ones where you and I just get into screaming matches where we start viciously insulting each other on a personal level.
Yeah.
Like when you called me a child.
Did I?
I don't know if it was me directly, but I said something about Queen of Earth. And
oh my
said,
God.
I don't know that because I am not a child. Implying then that...
Oh, right. Sure. Yeah. Sure.
But that's
sure.
Just ARP for you, you know?
Yeah.
I expect to have you back for the Winnie the Pooh podcast.
He's got a new one coming pretty soon, it seems.
Dear God.
Like maybe mid next year, it seems.
I can't wait.
Lolo or the Pooh?
No, his new movie Golden Exits with Emily Browning and Jason Schwartzman.
Oh my God.
When does Pooh come out?
I don't know.
That's crazy. All right. Well, let's tell the fine people at home where you two roustabouts can be found now that you can't be found often, at least, on this show. So, Danny King, why don't we kick it off with you?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/thekingbulletin. And I usually, you know, put all my links to stuff on there. So,
you can also look for him in the Village Voice.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly on the calendar. Feel free to just spend some time on the Twitter, and go through those tweets.
Really, you know, throw him some hearts.
I could use some faves for my brand.
Nick Newman, what about you?
Well, as always, thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman. And I would say, you know, if you're on social media, if you're on the internet, which I can only assume you are since you're listening to this, you should pay attention to Grasshopper Film, which will be releasing Robert Greene's Kate Plays Christine, one of this year's great films, starting August 24th.
Super excited for that movie.
Yeah, it looks dark.
Anyway, also, I should say that if you're, you know, this is a company that wants to release movies, wants them to be out, wants them to be seen. So if you live in a local area that doesn't, you know, if you have some sort of art house, independent theater or whatever, and they're not playing movies released by the company, you should get in contact with the theater and tell them to get in contact with us, because we always want more of our movies to be seen by a wider audience. So that goes out to you, the listener. You know, if you're in Oklahoma or something, and you have
Brattleboro,
a theater.
Outerboro,
is that what you said?
Isn't it Brattleboro? I don't know if that's a real place, but it sounds like it should be.
You know, you have a theater, say, hey, look up this company, get in touch with them about being put on the list. Do it. Let's make it happen, people.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, for joining us. It's been a treat. And yeah, I hope the people at home have enjoyed listening. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Next week, we will be talking about Pete's Dragon. It's a big change of pace for us coming off of Suicide Squad. Hopefully that'll be a better movie. Hopefully we will actually be able to talk about a movie that we're enthusiastic in our actual favor towards, because, sorry, Mike, but the last two times you've been on, now that you've become our new co-host, it's been movies that have not been that great. So hopefully we can get a good one for you soon.
Third time's the charm, guys.
Third time's the charm.
Certainly.
All right, and I want to remind everyone again that we are supported by Mubi, the curated online cinema streaming a selection of exceptional independent classic and award-winning films from around the world. Each day, Mubi handpicks a new gem, and you have 1 month to watch it. We spoke about it on the roundtable. They actually just released Metropolis, the Fritz Lang classic, to commemorate the 40th anniversary of his passing.
Pretty great
one. And again, we've got Kelly Reichert's work up, along with Meek's Cut Off and Old Joy, two movies well worth seeking out. Mm-hmm. Avoid Netflix, avoid Hulu, avoid rewatching the same television show's entire series run for the fourth time. Get yourself some Mubi in your life. Go to mubi.com/filmstage to get your 1 month free trial and see why with Mubi, less is more. Maybe that could be the catchphrase. Would that be a good catchphrase?
Less is more.
Less
I like
is more
it.
Because there's less choices, but there's more quality.
Oh.
Right? Anyway.
Man, you're going to make millions.
I know.
Send this man to Hollywood.
Send us your pitches, your taglines for Mubi to our Twitter account. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Find us on Facebook. Search for The Film Stage Show. Find us on thefilmstage.com. Give us a rating and review on iTunes. Gentlemen, let's tell the people at home where we can be found personally, starting with Michael Snidell.
Hi, guys. You can see me complaining about the state of the summer blockbuster and wanting it to be better at my Twitter handle at Snidell. And I write reviews and interviews and features at the Film Stage and Pace Magazine.
All right, Bill Graham.
You can find me riding in my purple Lamborghini over on Twitter at CableBFG. And you can find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter airing my suicidal thoughts at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me writing for TheFilmStage.com. We have a new list coming out. It's the 50 Ooh. Best comedies of the century so far. You can expect
Role models.
To discuss that on the newest roundtable, much as we did with sci-fi films. Other than that, yeah, hit me up all over the world wide web. If you find someone called Brian J. Rowan, odds are it's me. That is all for today. Ladies
you
and
know
gentlemen,
his
thank
name.
You for finding us here and listening to our 200th episode spectacular. I hope you have a great day, and I hope you join us next week when we talk about Pete's Dragon. Involved.